Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. Instead of the intro I normally do to start the show, we're going to time travel back almost 10 years together. I'm going to share with you an interview I did in July of 2009 with one of my most treasured mentors. At the time, my children were 1 and 3 years old, and I was a single mother, as I am now. I had just started a new business as a coach and consultant, and was recording interviews with some of the incredible social entrepreneurs who had been my colleagues over the previous decade in my work as an organizer and activist. So you'll hear me mention the Quantum Activist Network, which was the platform I was building at the time. And you'll recognize the intro music from Peter Mayer that I'm using still for The Inner Game. Please enjoy this rich conversation with evolutionary social entrepreneur Robert Egger.
Welcome. This is Gwen Garcelon here at the Quantum Activist Network, where we come together in community to be empowered in our purpose and in action in our lives, serving the common good. As we awaken our collective consciousness, we tap into the power of our collective reality. We are a 6 billion member strong collective reality here on planet Earth, and we have the choice to acknowledge the strength of that rather than bemoan and fear it. We have the choice to include each other in our decisions, in the way we live our lives, in our everyday habits. Gandhi advised that whenever you are feeling unsure and overwhelmed by your life, to think of the poorest person you have ever seen and ask yourself how your actions will impact that person. And as you take the well-being of others into account, you find your own fears and weakness melting away. Good advice. I've been loving Thich Nhat Hanh's latest book, The Art of Power, where he includes an entire chapter on the importance of sparking a collective awakening. Hanh, a Buddhist monk who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Martin Luther King, says everyone is responsible. The situation is too important to leave to the politicians alone. Without collective awakening, nothing will happen. Awakening is the foundation of every kind of change. Each of us has to sit down and look deeply to see what we can be and what we can do today. So together, here in the Quantum Activist community, we listen, we learn, and we look deeply at what we can do and be, and we awaken. Our guest today, Robert Egger, was looking around at his world in Washington, D.C. years ago, and instead of being overwhelmed by the homelessness and injustice around him, he decided he could do something very powerful and creative to address it. He founded the D.C. Central Kitchen, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that recovers unused food from hotels and restaurants, prepares and delivers meals to partner social service agencies, and trains and employs homeless men and women for the food service industry. Robert Egger has been awarded and acknowledged up the wazoo. I think that's the definitive measurement. But to name a few, he's been on the Nonprofit Times list of the 50 most powerful and influential leaders the last 3 years running. His book, Begging for Change, received the Nonprofit Management Book of the Year Award. And one of my personal favorites, he made Oprah Magazine's shortlist of the real sexiest men alive. We're so lucky to have Robert with us. I know him to be a relentless mover and shaker, a huge humanitarian, and really just one of those people who you are so damn grateful is in the world doing what they do. So, Robert, welcome to the Quantum Activist Network.
Well, thank you, Gwen. Man, I tell you, with an intro like that, I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we are so glad to have you. You know, I'm always intrigued by how people get their start on their path of activism and service, and I love your story about just wanting to open the greatest nightclub in the world. You were booking bands at clubs in Washington, D.C. when something really shifted for you. Tell us what happened with that.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, like many people, I was wandering the streets of Washington, D.C. during the day. I worked at night, you know, so I would wander around, and I started noticing, like everybody in the 80s, this really perplexing but growing number of men and women who were outside on the street. And like countless people, it's like, man, I wish somebody would do something. And, you know, there came a time when my wife and I, my wife is 25 years now, but we were looking for a place to get married, and there was this little church. And they had a thing called the Great Patrol, and they took turns with 6 other churches going out and serving people. And we ended up getting pulled out on this truck. And, you know, I did it very much against my will. I told the story so many times that I was the classic recovering hypocrite. You know, here I was talking about the power of music. I was going to use music in this nightclub to change the world, yet when somebody asked me if I would come out in my own backyard, I tried to make up every excuse not to go. And I ended up, you know, going out and nervously asking where's the food come from and found that it was purchased. And then when we pulled up to serve, here was people standing outside in the rain waiting for us to show up. And as we served people, you know, at one level I was having a very remarkably good time, but at the same time I kept looking and thinking, there's got to be more. And restaurants have food they're throwing out. They also have jobs. I wonder if you could set kind of the two things together somehow and create this bridge and somehow use that food that could be donated, not just to feed people, but to actually, you know, get people the skills they needed to get a job.
Right.
So the kitchen, interesting enough, was born right after that. I went back with a little business plan, interesting enough, based on FedEx, the model that Fred Smith had developed, which on paper looked crazy, but he was making it work by bringing all this mail all from all over the country back to Memphis, Tennessee, this hub, and then redirecting it. So I thought, man, FedEx for food. So the idea was a little business plan. If you bring it back, you can feed more people, better food, less waste, but you could also train people to cook. Ergo, you can shorten the line by the way you serve the line. Everybody would win.
So brilliant.
Well, I thought so. But no one, the big thing is I made the pitch and stood back waiting for the accolades to come showering down.
Right.
And all I heard was all the reasons it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of them were understandable. You know, all people thought, and they still do, you hear this kind of urban myth that it's illegal for restaurants to donate food. So that was kind of easy to shoot down. But then people started saying, to the point where they were clearly clutching, not out of malice, but just out of comfort and routine, they were starting to clutch at straws to keep from switching up from what they were used to doing to something new.
Uh-huh.
And the kind of the straw that broke the camel's back was someone said, you know, we know you mean well, but you can't train the homeless. And to me, that was kind of this gauntlet because it was like, A, man, they're not going to do this. And B, even though I was a front of the house nightclub person, but I knew enough about the back of the house to know food service, I kept thinking, man, this is not my bag, but I can do this and somebody should. I'll tell you what, I'll get it started, and then I'll go back to running nightclubs. But here you and I sit 21 years later talking about what a good life it's been.
Yes. And any regrets?
No, actually, it's funny. People often ask, you know, how did you go from running nightclubs to doing this?
Yeah.
Like I gave up something. And the reality is, I say all the time, it's like, look, man, I've been in service all my life.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised doing service. I've worked in restaurants. I didn't go to college. All I ever wanted to do was open a club. So since when I was 17, I've been serving people. And, you know, whether it's, you know, fat cats in suits or poor people in rags, I mean, I'm still doing service.
And what gets better and better about it, do you find?
Oh, man, I think just life in general gets better. I mean, we just had a farewell party today for a young woman who came here 10 years ago as an intern from Smith College, came back 3 years later as a frontline employee, and worked her way up to the COO position. And it was breathtaking to watch this, you know, what she represented, kind of the evolution of the kitchen and how, you know, we've become such an amazing organization, I think. You know, I don't say that out of boast or pride, but out of that sense of, you know, a lot of people worked, and she's one. This woman, Frances Reed, made so much of what we celebrate today happen through just dogged determination. You know, the cool notion that we could be that for somebody. You know, whether it's somebody who comes in to get training or a young person coming in looking for a way to make their life meaningful.
Right.
You know, the kitchen's been an open door, man, and I just think that rocks.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's, you know, not that you can't find that in the corporate world or elsewhere, but I think that's something really lovely about the nonprofit sector, how open it is to the creativity and brilliance of younger generation.
I mean, I think it captures the great entrepreneurial spirit that is, the you know, frankly, what's best about America. I mean, I think sometimes we look at the nonprofit sector and we see charity, or we see women's work, you know, or we see this kind of feminized charity thing. But I think what we fail to recognize is it represents, I think, what has always been best about America, which is a combination of that willingness to reach out and help somebody else up, but to do it in a way that constantly reinvents itself, to say, in effect, well, that's the way you did it, but I'm going to do it better, faster, stronger, because, gosh darn it, I'm an American. That's just the way we do business here.
Yahoo! Now, you are leading a movement to increase the power of the nonprofit sector in really driving national policymaking through the V3 campaign. And I'd love for you to talk about, you know, really what you see as the necessity of the voice of the nonprofit sector.
Well, you know, years ago, I was reading a very, very, I love reading about independence movements and liberation movements. And I was reading this amazing little thing on India. Of course, you know, like many people, you find yourself attracted to Gandhi and the Indian independence movement. But I read this teeny little footnote that just captured my attention. And it was a footnote, one of those things that you would go over and, you know, literally think, wait a second, stop, back up. What was that? And it said that the British never, ever had more than 3,000 officers stationed on the ground in India. Hmm. Now, again, my father was a Marine pilot, so I understand command structure, but still, that made me think, it's like, wait a second, 3,000 dudes, 350 million people, subcontinent, you know, for a century and a half.
Right.
So I was like, how did they do that? So I went to New Delhi to study this. I really went and allowed myself a month, and it took me a half a day to figure out that as long as the British could keep Indians divided by race, caste, class, geography, language, and fighting each other, it was easy. And when I was there at that moment, I had one of those, similar to my night on the truck when I kind of thought of the kitchen. I looked around, it's like, oh my goodness, that's the nonprofit sector in America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in effect, we're one-tenth of the American economy. 80 million people volunteer. You know, we're one of the major employers in every single American city. I kept thinking, you know, wow, if we could, like the Indians, like African Americans, like civil rights workers, like migrant workers with Cesar Chavez, if we could find common ground, what an amazing voice we could be. Instead of fighting each other for little change, we could actually be, you know, kind of united,
right,
to fight for big change. And see, you have to understand, I don't want to make the kitchen out to be like, you know, some kind of business thing. It is a business. It's a rock solid business. And I'm always thinking, and I know what's coming for me. And the future for me and food programs all across America is we are going to see less donated food, which is our entire food bank pantry system,
mm-hmm,
is based primarily on donated food,
mm-hmm,
extra food. But the reality is that food represents lost profit. And there is an inevitable, and you're seeing it now rapidly, a decreasing supply. And frankly, what's left has questionable nutritional value.
Right.
And then on the other side, I see 80 million people my age, baby boomers, 12,000 people turn 60 every day in America, and there's already a waiting list in half of American cities for Meals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, wow, less food, a huge wave of older Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I could never possibly meet the need. We're not even meeting the need today.
Mm-hmm.
So my attitude was, wow, it doesn't matter how efficient I make my program. We can't charity our way out of hunger.
Right.
It's going to take a broader societal conversation. It's going to take, as you so eloquently put in your introduction, you know, a switch from that faith and that sense of it's not the nonprofit's job. It's our job as,
yeah,
a society. This is our decision.
Right.
Do we want to live in a society in which we just put our elders who built this country, who fought those wars, who worked for civil rights, for women who fought for equal pay,
mm-hmm,
do we want to put them out to pasture, or do we really want to acknowledge what an amazing well of life experience they represent?
Exactly, yeah.
So while part of me wants to channel the economic and political power of the nonprofit sector, it's not to become another, like, you know, special interest group in Washington. It's to kind of invoke this new era of discussion about what kind of society we want to live in, and frankly, electing a new generation of leaders who aren't afraid to talk about that, but at the same time also recognize the amazing conduit for that energy and that entrepreneurial spirit that the nonprofit sector is, and with a great partnership, what we could be in the future.
This is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KD&K. Today we're listening to an interview I did in 2009 with Robert Egger on the evolving role of nonprofit organizations in our world.
And so what will that look like? What is the V3 campaign actually doing as it organizes voices from the nonprofit sector.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up because the V3 thing, it's kind of one of my little silly plays on words. I wanted to be a 501 V3, which mm-hmm. says, you know, that the voice and the value and the vote of the nonprofit sector mm-hmm. count.
Okay.
And what I'm after is I want the sector to start to think about what issues can we speak with one voice on, because we need to speak with a united voice. And the primary areas are value, the fact that we create millions of jobs, pay billions in payroll taxes, that are and the economics of what we produce, far from non-profit, what we produce is by far some of the best profit in America, and frankly, some of the most reliable profit. And thirdly, again, I want us to be aware that our votes make the difference between the status quo and real change. So what we're doing is trying to activate kind of in every election in America. For example, this fall, there will be about 400 mayor's races. Next year, there will be 36 governor's races in what's been called a once-in-a-lifetime generational shift. And what we want to do is activate nonprofit people so that they, A, understand that they can, in fact, be involved in the political process. Like I mentioned earlier, that urban myth that restaurants can't donate food.
Right.
Similarly, many nonprofits are ill-informed, and frankly, oftentimes their board of directors are uninformed about how far we can be involved.
Yes.
Really, we're only limited in really being partisan. You know, we can't overtly work for one candidate or endorse candidates, but we have many miles to go and much to do before we cross that line. But so the idea is getting people involved and asking questions of candidates that really get them to respond in their own words and kind of express their sense of, you know, what do you know about this town and the people that you want to represent as far as the nonprofit sector, how much money they give, where they volunteer, the community service aspect of all our kids doing community service, and how would you channel that to achieve your vision for this town or this state or this country? And again, what we're after, as I said earlier, is a generation of politicians who see the nonprofit sector not as just good deed doers, but frankly, the economic and social backbone and life's blood of every community in America, and really reach out and say, if you elect me, I will help in partnering with you mm-hmm. as an equal. I will bring business, nonprofits, and government to the table, and we will divine a way in which all our citizens have an active role in making this an amazing place to live, run a business, raise a family.
Mm-hmm. So really, it sounds like a lot of the campaign is about just awakening a consciousness in the nonprofit sector.
I got to be honest
with you. Power.
Yeah, I mean, Gwen, once this starts, man, I don't even remotely anticipate trying to stand in front of it. It's going to be a domino. Once people see that you can and you should do this, everywhere you go, this will happen. And frankly, this is international. There really isn't an election in the world in which the role of NGOs and regular citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Americans, we're very far ahead in certain aspects of philanthropy. For example, no other country has a level of volunteerism like we do, and very few countries have the economic contributions that we do. But many other countries are further along in dynamic new programs like social enterprise or microcredit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great learning curve in which I think throughout the world we're going to share robust new ideas about what is a civil society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does capitalism need to be a consumption-driven process, or can it be a consumer-driven
mm-hmm.
process?
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of V3 is also very much about social enterprise. And again, microcredit, trying to elect people who see this as not as a novel experiment, but a potential unlocking of a bold new era of philanthropy in which the way you spend your money every day is how you support your community, not the check at the end of the year.
You know, I love what you say in your Robert's Rules for nonprofits. One of them is, don't give to any organization that sets up the problem and not the solution. Remember, pity isn't a plan. Now, coming from a background in lobbying, of course, for social change, I get excited when I hear people talking about the real power of changing the systems that are creating the problems rather, you know, of course, than just band-aiding the problems. And I would love for you to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, when I first came into this side of the biz, and I call it an industry at times, but in the hunger side, I got to be honest with you, I was a little bit put off by the preponderance of programs that wanted to put a child in front of their appeal. Now, again, it's certainly wrong when a child goes hungry, but I personally believe that it's always wrong when a senior goes hungry, or a prostitute, or a mentally ill person, or a homeless person.
Mm-hmm.
All hunger to me is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got very frustrated by this kind of, it wasn't intended, But what it started to do is you almost created this caste system that, you know, it's like everybody wants to feed a kid, but that leaves other programs kind of holding the heavy load of having to raise money for those who might not be as sympathetic. So I became much more interested in the bigger issue of, like, you know, look, man, I mean, with all due respect, I'm not interested in just meeting the need today. I want to do something. I mean, you know, I didn't give up my nightclub dream so that I could become a permanent hunger fighter. I mean, I really wanted, like many people, it's like, no, man, I want to kick some ass. I want to make something happen. You know, at the end of the day, man, you know, when I started the kitchen, I was a new father. And, you know, I have a mad passion, you know, a passionate love for my daughter and my city. And, you know, the goal was I wanted to make this city a better place, and I wanted to make a better place for my daughter and anybody else's kid to grow up in. So I don't want to let go of that. I don't want to kind of fall into that boring routine of, like, well, I can only do what I do. I still want to believe that if you work really hard and you're imaginative and you bring other people into the fold, you really can change the world. So that's pretty much what I just keep doing.
And are you seeing a shift in the nonprofit sector? Are more people, I mean, I know there's so many organizations out there who are beautifully serving needs that need to be served, but is there that shift of, you know, really let's look at the systems that are creating this need so we're not just running on a treadmill of, you know, meet the need, meet the need, meet the need? Is that shift occurring?
Yeah, and it's going to be a little uncomfortable. Now, if we got a minute here, I'll give you something that I think is very important to think about. Because I went through a phase of being kind of mad, agitated, bored by traditional charity. And again, that sense, that thing I first went into, that willingness, that clinging to the routine as opposed to being wide open to change. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the people who were doing that were somehow bad. And I became more and more aware of, A, routine is natural. People, it's understandable that people go to a comfort zone, that people get into a place where it's easy. It's just what people do. It's natural.
Right.
So I don't begrudge anybody that. But I also became very aware, and I'll do this very quickly, but, you know, in the late 1960s, there were only like 75, 80,000 nonprofits in America. And something happened, and I was wondering, what happened? Where did all these nonprofits come from? And I went back and looked, and fascinating enough, you know, this is a very fuzzy history. I don't want to act like I've done some kind of deep research. But nonetheless, what I think happened is, a lot of people in the early 1970s were frankly thrilled to see the 1960s in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hippies graduated college and cut their hair and became yuppies. And the cities, the racial turmoil started to simmer down, and cities that were on fire in the 60s, the flames went down a little bit. And Vietnam was starting to end. And frankly, the kind of crazed rebellion that was rock and roll of the 60s started giving way to disco and kind of that easy listening sound.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's, a lot of people were real happy to see that stuff kind of end up,
mm-hmm.
Or start to, you know, kind of wind down. And you know who didn't get the memo, interestingly enough, was my mother's generation, which were these college-educated women who had, in the 1960s, married their college sweetheart and gone out to the beginning of the kind of suburbs and raised their kids. And, you know, after 18 years, when we started moving away, millions of these women came out of the home and said, in effect, look, I was a college-educated
right.
woman,
right.
and I'm proud of the role I played as a mother and a wife, but now it's my turn, you know, and I want to go out there and make my mark. Well, when they went out, there was nobody who was willing to hire somebody with an 18-year gap between their degree. No one at the time, and still, unfortunately, to this day, we still don't give women their due professionally for what they did in the home.
Right.
And so what happened is those women had very little recourse but to start nonprofits. You know, from the sidelines, they watched civil rights and the women's movement and the environmental movement, and they watched issues that used to be limited to the inner city kind of migrate out into the suburbs. And they're like, you know what? I'm going to make my mark. You know, I'm going to keep Dr. King's dream alive. I'm going to keep John Lennon's dream alive,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they started nonprofits. And we're talking about tens of thousands of nonprofits. We went from like 75,000 to a million nonprofits in 15 years. But those women ran into two interesting barriers. One was kind of the gender bias of the broader society. And more importantly, what happened when they went to the foundation world looking for grants was they ran into a group of people, and you got to understand this was primarily money made by white men, given away by other white men.
Mm-hmm.
They ran into a foundation world that said, sisters, you know, the 60s are over. we will gladly give you pennies to go feed leftover food to poor people, mm-hmm. or to plant flowers, or to elevate the arts. And we'll humor you. We'll give you some awards every once in a while.
Right.
But we're never going to give you money that will make you independent. We will never give you money for economic liberation, and we will never allow you to be political. And so that generation of women, with love in their hearts, they didn't do anything bad, but they kind of got spun off in a million directions and never stopped to look back and say, wow, look at how many of us there are.
Mm-hmm.
So for 40 years, we've been, so for 40 years, we've been making that form of charity bigger, bigger, bigger. And there was a time, and I was part of it, in which people thought, maybe if I make it more efficient. And then suddenly, like many people, you had this awakening to say, wow, maybe it wasn't supposed to work.
So it's the real paradigm shift.
It is.
That paradigm came out of, you know, the societal dynamic that you just, you know, really beautifully described, and you can see how that's been perpetuated.
Exactly.
But it is now shifting.
And it's a little bit uncomfortable because, again, people have grown comfortable in this routine here.
Right.
And, you know, and nobody wants to say there's no villains here. This was just a natural process. But now we're at this, and I say it's a generational shift, but Gwen, I don't mean age-wise. But what you're seeing is whether it's young people, a generation 80 million strong, mind you, mm-hmm. that's coming out of our school system who've been raised doing community service.
Right.
And they have a very different idea about philanthropy, and quite frankly, they have a very different economic future ahead of them, which means they're not going to have the checks at the end of the year. They're not going to be able to write checks like our generation did.
Mm-hmm.
And they want something, they want their lifestyle to be their philanthropy.
Right.
They want their job to be their philanthropy.
Right. They don't want that separation.
Bingo. And I think that to me is staggering in its potential.
We'll end with that thought for now. It's one of my favorite insights from this conversation with Robert, which is the evolutionary shift that began with a disillusionment with wealth and the status quo of many in my generation, Gen Xers, and has blossomed among the millennials. This choice to have our lifestyle be our contribution, rather than accumulating wealth in ways that may be out of alignment with our values and attempting to offset that through philanthropy. Tune in next month for the rest of this conversation with Robert Egger, where he has much more to say about the potential of the nonprofit sector, or as we prefer to call it, the social profit sector. And you'll hear him talk more about his inner game. And please join the Facebook page at The Inner Game if you have a question or comment about this conversation, or to find out where to listen to past shows. Until next time, as Robert would say, make your life a badass machine of love.
Seeds are hopeful, dewdrops fleeting, oak trees crooked, redwoods straight.